Welcome to the Ask the Expert Show, where the experts offer you educational information from local experts in the field of legal health, financial, and home improvement. Join us every week at this time for great educational information from lawyers, doctors, contractors, and specialists in their field. Sit back and enjoy the next hour of Ask the Experts.
Good morning. This is Lisa Jordan.
I'm Lee Schwartz.
We're of Schwartz Jordan Law Group in Philadelphia. We offer family law counseling, and we are here to address some of the custody factors today. We did a show a couple of weeks ago where we went through some of the custody factors that the court looks at in awarding custody. So, Lee, we left off at our last session with the factor regarding the well-reasoned preferences of the child. What are your thoughts on how the court views the preferences of the child?
I think the key part of that phrase is well-reasoned. And I think well-reasoned is looked at in one of two ways in most cases, or sometimes both ways in cases. Well-reasoned has to do with the age of the child. And I think that in a general sense, and of course it depends on the maturity of the child, and that's something to be assessed by the judge also. But generally, preference is not going to be considered, I don't think, until a child is in the double digits. Mm-hmm. I don't know that a preference of an 8-year-old is going to be given much credence, because it's probably not well-reasoned. And well-reasoned, I think, is mature. So what will a judge look at with an 8-year-old child? A judge is going to, I think, is going to assess the comfort level that the child has with each parent, and who is the emotional rock for this kid. Who's the parent that this child goes to when they're upset and feels comfortable exposing themselves emotionally to, and feels as though they're going to get a non-judgmental response. Of course, that supposes one of the two parents can actually do that. But I think once you get into the teenage years, in a general sense, with both parents being looked at as being good parental models for the child, I think a child with a strong preference, many judges are going to lean in that direction. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's one factor.
Sure.
The factors are supposed to be evenly weighed by the court. Whether they are or not is subject to greater discussion. But I think that's kind of how preference works.
Yeah. And my clients often ask me whether there is a hard and fast rule as to what age a child's preference is given, sway. And there isn't any hard and fast rule. It's a case-by-case assessment. You might have an 8-year-old who is extremely articulate and extremely mature. You might have a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old who, for a variety of circumstances, may not be terribly mature. There are also, and we kind of got into an assessment of some of these other issues when we had our forensic psychologist,
Dr. Romorowski.
That's right, Dr. Romorowski last time. But there may be cases where a child has been under the influence of one parent, or there's an allegation that a child has been unduly influenced by a parent. And the court will take a look at, how that factors into the child's preference as well.
And I think your statement about the 8-year-old and the 14-year-old is correct. And I think, again, it's well-reasoned.
You have
to look at what the reasons are. An 8-year-old coming in and saying, I want to be with mom, for example, because it's more fun, I'm not sure that's going to carry much weight.
Right.
An 8-year-old coming in and saying, I want to be with mom because she helps me with my homework, because I have a schedule, and I find out that when I go to bed at 8 o'clock, I feel better in school the next day. I don't fall asleep. And that's a very mature child at 8. But, it's certainly possible, depending on the kid. So it depends on what the reasons are that this child is giving for their preference.
Sure. And interestingly, one of the other things that is of concern to some of my clients is, well, when my child is testifying, am I going to be there? Is the other parent going to be there? How is my child going to be able to articulate how he or she feels in front of his parents? And speak to that.
Well, the child, in the vast majority, and the reason I say vast majority is I had a bizarre experience with a judge in Philadelphia where she had a six-year-old child get on the witness stand, raise, I think it was a little boy, raise his right hand, get sworn in, and testify in front of mom and dad. I'm not going to say who the judge is. But that, with that one experience as the gross exception to the rule, the child testifies without the parents there in all cases, testifies in the judge's chambers generally, which is just his the judge's office. The lawyers, by court rule, have the right to be there, but I think good lawyers do not accept that opportunity, in my view. Now, there's other, that's a subject of discussion between lawyers, and I think each individual case, certainly there are cases where it's warranted, perhaps. But my view is that I think it's very stressful for kids to have to meet with this unknown person in this robe and talk about their feelings. This is a person they don't know. And I think the less people in the room for that conversation, I think the child may be more likely to be honest and be forthright in this very stressful, unfamiliar situation. So I get that question all the time, too. You know, my kid's going to have to testify in front of the other party or in front of me. And the answer, I say, is no. But again, I had this unusual experience.
Yeah. And that also, the rule that says that a lawyer shall be present, or shall have the right to be present, is sometimes complicated when there is one lawyer and the other side is represented, is unrepresented, rather. And the other side, the unrepresented party, won't waive his presence.
Yeah, that's what I generally do, and it's in that situation, if the judge will look at me first and say, under the rule, you know, under the rule, you have a right to be there, do you wish to be there? I will preface my response by saying, Your Honor, I find that the children tend, or the child tends to be more comfortable with the less people that are in the room. So I generally waive that opportunity. And my hope is that if the other unrepresented parent is listening, they'll kind of go, yeah, that probably is a good idea.
Right.
And we'll waive that right to be there. And if they don't, sometimes judges will kind of prod them a little bit to waive the right. But if an unrepresented litigant wants to be in the room, then I'm going to be in the room too.
Yeah, and I've had that very scenario occur, and it unfolded exactly as you've described. The judge kind of made a statement that children tend to be more comfortable in a situation where it's just the judge and the child, because it is stressful, and that's pretty much a universal truth, that going to court and having to testify in a contest that you know to be about your parents and where you're going to stay is just very stressful.
There actually was a video made by the Pennsylvania Bar Association, I believe it was the Pennsylvania Bar Association, Family Law Section, called Judicial Interview of the Child. And I urge parents to go to our website at www.schwartzjordan.com, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z-J-O-R-D-A-N.com. And if you look at the home page on the left-hand side, you'll see a tab for Judicial Interview of the Child, and it's a video. And it's very well done, and it's something that I encourage my clients, if children are going to be interviewed, to go to the website and look at it. It's a well-invested half hour or 40 minutes, and it really gives you a pretty comfortable idea of what the process is.
Yeah. One of the things that my clients also ask me is, what should I say to my child about the fact that they're going to be interviewed by the child? And my answer is, nothing except tell the truth. What do you, how do you handle that?
I go a little bit more than that. I certainly, in every case, say tell the truth, but I also say tell your child that you're going to meet with the judge privately, probably privately, that the judge is going to be very patient with the child and is not going to make you make a choice. This is all about the judge just wanting to get to know you. And you're going to talk about what activities you do and how school and, you know, what goes on in each home, but within a very non-judgmental way, and nobody's going to make you make a choice. And just try and comfort your child a little bit, because what's going to happen is your child's going to be outside the courtroom. The judge's clerk or secretary or some person's going to walk out and say, "Where's little Johnny?" And it's gonna, that at that moment, the child's going to be very stressed. So just give them a little introduction, but don't talk about what you want them to say, or don't talk about anything other than just tell the truth.
Right. And it is very, very important, I think, for the kids to know that that they're not going to be in a position of having to choose. I think it's that's a wonderful piece of advice, because the kids shouldn't have that
power.
So is there anything you want to add about that?
I don't think so. I think that you, the preference is a rare commodity, even though it says well-reasoned preference of the child. I think it's well-reasoned comfort of the child. I think that's really what it's about.
Right, right. And most children, I think, don't want to be disloyal to either parent. And so many, many children take great pains to not be disloyal or to be perceived as disloyal.
And to kind of step away from that a little bit and extrapolate on it at the same time, I think as parents going through this custody situation, you've got to have a long-term view of this. You know, if your child is 6 years old right now, you're going to be involved in this melee for the next 12 years. And what I advise my clients is your child is going to gravitate, in most cases, to the parent who provides the structure, the parent who provides the discipline, the parent who provides limits. So don't be in a situation where you're thinking that if all you're doing is having fun in your house, but there's no structure, there's no bedtime, there's no discipline, that somehow you're going to win or you're going to end up with your child. When your child reaches the age of X, whatever that is, this child is going to gravitate in most cases to the parent who has provided that that parental structure.
And I think that's absolutely right. We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be right back.
The Schwartz Jordan Law Group's philosophy in family law is simple: to provide you with the legal advice and support you need in order to make sound, educated decisions that prepare you for your future. They can help you with all types of family law issues, including the complete divorce process. Much of their practice involves contested or uncontested divorce matters, such as alimony and division of property, including retirement assets, stock options, and business interests. Schwartz Jordan have a great deal of experience assisting clients in family law issues involving children, paternity actions, child custody, and child support. They also represent clients outside of the divorce process, drafting prenuptial agreements and postnuptial agreements, and assisting with the modification of domestic orders and child support enforcement. For more information or to discuss your divorce or family law case, call Schwartz Jordan Law today at 215-967-9070. That's 215-967-9070, or go to their website, schwartzjordan.com.
And we're back. So, Lee, I want to pivot a little bit and go to the next factor in the child custody factors that need to be assessed in awarding custody. And the next factor is the attempts of a parent to turn the child against the other parent. It's a big issue in lots of our custody cases.
There is absolutely no utility. There is no benefit. None. Zero. To a parent talking poorly about the other parent, to a parent trying to convince the child that they should live with them, to a parent doing anything that paints the other parent in a bad light. If you want to do that outside of the hearing and knowledge of your child, I'm not so sure that's a good idea either, because in the world of email and text, everything is fair game. But you're just not helping yourself, and you're hurting yourself very dramatically, because, I mean, I can talk more about Philadelphia County, I think, than some other counties, because we're there so much. But the judges in Philadelphia County generally use the children as the truth meters in these custody cases. So the parents can get on the stand and say A, B, C, and D, but some of this is going to be very gently confirmed or denied by the kids, and generally the kids are going to be believed. Yeah. So stay away from that.
I would agree with that. I would also say that it is really, really important to be mindful of what comes out of your mouth. Children are sponges. Sometimes we're not really aware of how our negativity is, you know, flowing forth from our mouths, because it's kind of an automatic thing. Find some other way to vent, people. Talk to your friends. Don't speak negatively on the phone to your friends in about the other parent.
I was going to bring that up. What about people who don't talk directly to their children in a negative way, but the child's in the living room watching TV and the parent is in the kitchen just berating the other parent to their girlfriend, boyfriend, mother, father, whatever?
Right. It has the same effect on a child. And the child has the right and should be encouraged to love the other parent. It is best for the child that he or she should be encouraged to have a relationship with the other parent. So that's the end game. And we need to keep that in mind. The child is a piece of both parents. And when you speak negatively about the other parent in the presence of the child, you're also implicating that child. And the child feels implicated.
I have a case going to trial in a couple of weeks where the children are telling dad that mom is saying that she would happily kill the father and spend time in jail, be happy to be in jail to do that. And the children are hearing this.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
Yeah. And I think it is, you know, again, it's being mindful of what our issues are, and we've all got them. Being mindful of what our issues and what our triggers are so that we don't impose whatever we've got going on with us as adults on our kids.
And if you find that you're unable to do that, for that reason, plus a host of many other reasons, therapy. Go talk to somebody, and a good therapist can give you the skills to learn how not to do that in front of your kid.
Right. And it may be that you have some righteous anger about what happened in the relationship that ended, that produced these children. I'm not saying that there might not be some righteous anger, but that righteous anger needs to be resolved through some other forum that insulates the child from it. So that's the one piece of advice that I reinforce upon my clients, because when you think about it, what happens is these patterns of behavior just perpetuate from generation to generation if we don't resolve them.
Do you find that clients sometimes are concerned with telling you they're in therapy because they're afraid a court's going to look at them as having some sort of mental illness or some sort of disability, and they're concerned with even admitting that they're in therapy?
Yes, that's a huge, huge, huge concern for many of my clients, and I try to encourage them to take the philosophical view, and that is, you know, working on yourself, working on being a better person and healing from whatever you've had festering for a number of years only helps your parenting. It only helps your children, because your children see, hey, having having some fallibilities just makes me human. I can work on them, and that makes me a better human.
Yeah. So, and so conversely, it's not the person who's in therapy that is looked at poorly. It's the person who objectively has a need for therapy and doesn't do it.
Right.
That may be looked at in a poor light.
Right. And there are also some concerns, and I don't want to overlook the concerns that sometimes folks who need therapy might not be able or might not think they're able to afford therapy. So there are some resources in the city that provide low-cost therapy for folks in need. They are available. You have to search them, search for them, seek them out. But I refer my clients, some of whom don't have a lot of disposable income, to those services.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly there are therapists that charge $200 an hour, and they're unaffordable for many people.
Right.
But there certainly are a lot of services in Philadelphia. But again, you do have to, amazingly, it's not something that's easily discoverable. It does take some work.
Right, right. Group therapy out there, you might pay $5 a session for group therapy. And listening to other people's stories and knowing that you're not alone is really helpful, I think, in parenting. Because you think, I know often people think, well, I'm doing this all wrong. I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm keeping it to myself. I've got this problem with a child-related issue, and it's like I'm on an island. I can't talk to anybody about this because they'll think that I don't know what I'm doing. So group therapy is a good place to discover that you're not alone and get some insights.
And I find that in the beginning of my discussion, my first meeting, my second meeting with a client, in many cases, I bring up the concept of therapy if the client's not in it, because there's very few people who can't benefit from it. Listen, this is a traumatic time of your life. You went into this loving relationship with this person, most people thinking this was it for life, and there's an aspect to it that some people believe that they're a failure because it didn't work. Or there's a multitude of reasons, and they feel poorly about it, and if the adjustment isn't made, the psychological adjustment isn't made, that those poor feelings can come out in a host of ways.
Right. And one of the things that I like to say to my clients to kind of hopefully reorient their thinking is, do you love your parents? You do, don't you? Did they do everything right? Do you feel that they did everything right? No, they could have changed some things, don't you think? And I think that kind of helps them put things in perspective.
I think that's really good. I think I'll use that.
So tell us, have you ever had an issue with a child needing therapy or an allegation that a child needed therapy? In a custody case?
Happens in many, many custody cases. Many times it comes out of either a child acting out in an inappropriate manner or a child doing poorly in school. And these are just adjustment issues sometimes. It's not an indication, again, of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, this is very traumatic for children. I mean, you go from even a home where there's been fighting in front of the children, both parents are there, and that's there's a unit that the children are accustomed to, and that doesn't mean at all that a person should stay with a spouse in a bad marriage because of that unit. But the breakup of that unit for this child it turns the world upside down.
That's absolutely right. We're going to need to take a break right now, but we will be back in a moment.
The Schwartz Jordan Law Group's philosophy in family law is simple: to provide you with the legal advice and support you need in order to make sound, educated decisions that prepare you for your future. They can help you with all types of family law issues, including the complete divorce process. Much of their practice involves contested or uncontested divorce matters such as alimony and division of property, including retirement assets, stock options, and business interests. Schwartz Jordan have a great deal of experience assisting clients in family law issues involving children, paternity actions, child custody, and child support. They also represent clients outside of the divorce process, drafting prenuptial agreements and postnuptial agreements, and assisting with the modification of domestic orders and child support enforcement. For more information or to discuss your divorce or family law case, call Schwartz Jordan Law today at 215-967-9070. That's 215-967-9070, or go to their website, schwartzjordan.com.
And we're back. Lee, you said something at the end before we went to break about not needing to stay in a relationship where there's domestic violence or it's just a bad relationship. And the factor that we've been discussing about the attempts of a parent to turn a child against the other parent has an exception regarding cases of domestic violence where it's to protect a child from harm. So I just think that's an important point that mm-hmm. you raised, that there may be some cases where you have to take certain steps to make sure that your family is safe.
Yes.
And this the statute takes the view that that is not an impermissible attempt to turn a child away from the other parent or against the other parent.
Talk for a second, Lisa, about how these factors fit into a custody trial. I mean, how are they used by the court? Are they always used by the court? Why don't you just talk about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. So when, as a preface to these 16 factors, you mentioned before that there's no real weight. They're not weighted in any order.
What does that mean?
What that means is factor five is not necessarily given more weight than factor six. The only factors that are weighted in this 16 factor list are those factors that go to the safety of the child. So if you've got an issue where a child is there's an allegation that a child is being harmed, that the child is not receiving adequate nutrition, that there is anything that goes to the child's physical or emotional safety, those things are weighted. The court must give them more weight.
So a parent's in a home with a child or children, they have no family in the area, they have nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
What does that parent do? If they need to leave, what are there resources in the area that can assist them? You know, such as are there shelters? Are there places
Absolutely.
Temporarily that a parent could go with their children just to get out of the house?
There are shelters in the city. There's one in particular that comes to the top of my head, and that's the Women Against Abuse Shelter.
Mm-hmm.
There are.
How does that work? I mean, what?
So yes, if there is an abusive event and somebody is placed in reasonable fear of serious imminent bodily injury, then they might seek a protection from abuse order, and those the right to seek such an order is available 24/7. If a person seeks protection from abuse during the week, they can go to 1501 Arch Street, the Family Court Building, and there's a domestic violence unit where the domestic violence unit staffers will help them file a petition. That petition will be reviewed by a judge that very same day. The folks or the person who has made the filing would state before a judge on the record the reasons that they believe they need protection that same day, and potentially a temporary ex parte order might be entered. And what that means is that's fancy speech for an order might be entered that same day without the other party, the defendant, being available to testify. But it's a temporary order which would then be reviewed within the next 10 days with both parties being given the opportunity to put their testimony on the record.
So going back to the factors then, mm-hmm. is abuse or the presence of abuse one of the factors for custody?
So it is. However, when I say that it is, I have to clarify that or qualify that a little bit, because if there has been no abuse of the child, then people often think that because there was abuse to a parent, that the other parent is not going to have any custodial time with the child. That is incorrect. If the child, if there have been allegations that the child has been harmed, there will still be some custodial rights for the other parent in most instances. Those rights might be exercised in a supervised way, with a court staffer perhaps supervising the visits at the courthouse, or there could be an alternative supervisor agreed upon. But there will, in most cases, in almost all cases, there will still be some custodial provisions made.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
So the other thing that is interesting about the domestic violence provisions is I often have clients who say, well, he abused me when I was pregnant with my child.
Right.
Shouldn't that be considered? And the answer to that is that's domestic violence. If you were abused while you were pregnant, then you should certainly seek out a protection from abuse order. In terms of custody, the child is not technically here yet.
Right.
So there's not going to be any abuse of that child.
What's your experience with judges in protection from abuse situations discussing custody or temporary custody or making some provision for custody?
So if there is no custody order in effect when there is a temporary or a protection from abuse order filed, if there is a temporary ex parte order entered, I find that the judges may sometimes say, go file a petition and let custody court handle that. If there is a custody order that has been entered prior to the protection from abuse action, and the order requires that the parents have some contact in terms of exchanging the children, then the protection from abuse judge may sometimes have a provision in a protection from abuse order that temporarily modifies the exchange provisions of the custody order so that the exchanges occur at a police station or at curbside of the parents' residences, depending upon the circumstances. But a protection from abuse judge would modify temporarily a custody order while the protection from abuse order is in effect to prevent contact between the parents or to prevent there being a violation of the protection from abuse order.
Mm-hmm. So in a violation situation, describe what a violation of a protection from abuse order might be. Like what kind of incidents might give rise to that?
So a protection from abuse order may take a variety of forms. But let's take the classic full statutory protection order, which says that there shall be no contact between the plaintiff and the defendant in a case. And that no contact means that you can't make phone calls, you can't send text messages, you can't have other parties, you can't contact each other through third parties. If you violate any of those provisions of a full protection order, it becomes potentially a quasi-criminal matter, a violation. Or an alleged violation of the protection order could have some criminal implications. So it's very important that those provisions of no contact be observed. Now, in a custody situation, this is difficult. If you have an order that says that you are to communicate about all major decisions involving a child, which is what legal custody means. Legal custody is when it's shared. it means that parents are to communicate about all major issues involving a child, including but not limited to medical, educational, religious issues. Let's say you have a medical procedure for a child and a protection order that's a full protection order. And on the one hand, the custody order requires you to contact the other parent and to advise them that there's a medical issue and get their consent as to a medical procedure. How do you do that without violating the other order and finding yourself potentially in a courtroom with a DA in front of a judge trying to protect yourself in a contempt situation? So that's why there is some interplay between the domestic violence statute and the custody statute, that you really should seek some legal assistance in disentangling, because the implications are serious.
Quite serious.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. It's a very difficult situation when you've got this order that people are not supposed to communicate with each other, but you need to communicate pursuant to another order.
That's right. So I've monopolized the time, and I think we have 1 minute, or we have to go to a break right now.
Right.
Wait, okay. So we're gonna go to break. Thank you.
The Schwartz Jordan Law Group's philosophy in family law is simple. To provide you with the legal advice and support you need in order to make sound, educated decisions that prepare you for your future. They can help you with all types of family law issues, including the complete divorce process. Much of their practice involves contested or uncontested divorce matters, such as alimony and division of property, including retirement assets, stock options, and business interests. Schwartz Jordan have a great deal of experience assisting clients in family law issues involving children, paternity actions, child custody, and child support. They also represent clients outside of the divorce process, drafting prenuptial agreements and postnuptial agreements, and assisting with the modification of domestic orders and child support enforcement. For more information or to discuss your divorce or family law case, call Schwartz Jordan Law today at 215-967-9070. That's 215-967-9070, or go to their website, schwartzjordan.com.
I want to shift a little bit. We spent a lot of time talking about domestic violence. I want to move on to the next factor in the custody statute, which is which party is more likely to maintain a loving, stable, consistent, and nurturing relationship adequate to the child's emotional needs.
And I think that goes back to what we talked about before, and that's the parent who maintains structure in the home, the parent who makes sure the kid's homework gets done, or gets the kid to the extracurricular activity, or establishes a structure for dinner time, bedtime. Again, you're looking for the more stable parent. Now, sometimes both parents are equally stable, and it's not a factor. And when I say stable, I'm not talking about emotionally stable. I'm talking about creating stability for the children, because a child wants stability, and a child gravitates towards stability. I think sometimes parents mistake, like we said before, that if they make their home a fun home but with no structure or stability, that's better for the child. That's what the child wants, or that'll convince the child to live with me. And that is just counterintuitive to the reality.
Right. And it's you mentioned that we often have the fun parent and the structured parent. And the fun parent thinks, if I take the child to a great adventure, if I take the child to the movies, maybe that'll be an inducement to live with me. Can you talk about how vital you think it is for parents to be on the same page, and how the courts look at that parental communication in custody cases?
I think it's looked at differently today than it was before the advent of the text. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon right now for a judge to permit text communication when vocal communication is difficult. So I think the burden actually is even higher now for parents to maintain communication, because in texting, number one, it's provable. You can print them out and show the judge what the texting is. And it's easier because you're not dealing with the reflexive, inappropriate commentary from the other parent that we used to get many times when people had to communicate by phone because there was no other way to do it. So I think judges are looking for parents who do, obviously, who do communicate and communicate appropriately. Mm-hmm. People have to look at their communications, whether they're verbal on a phone message or in writing. Every communication has to be looked at from the perspective of what would a judge think if a judge saw this or heard this. And if that's your guidepost, if that's what it's come down to for a person, it's a good guidepost in a custody case. Because if you are inappropriate in your written or verbal communications where messages are being left, and I've had people leave phone messages in cases that were ridiculous, and we play them in court, and it's their voice, and it's just be mindful of that because it's going to come back to haunt you.
Absolutely. And I always inform my clients that they should prepare to have everything that they've ever written and ever said, now that we're in a custody battle, prepare for everything that you've ever said to be an issue, and write and speak like everything you say from now on will be presented as evidence in trial.
So in talking about that, do you, and I do, and I'm sure you do also, do you talk about social media with your clients and Facebook and Instagram and whatever?
See, this is why we're partners. You just read my mind. I was going to talk, that was the next thing I was going to talk about. The first thing I do, and I probably shouldn't let my trade secret out there over the internet, but over the airwaves rather, but first thing I do is I will look at your Facebook profile, and I'm going to check the other party's Facebook profile if I have access to it to see what's out there. And you would be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't be, but by how many inappropriate things are said on social media by parents about the fathers or mothers of their children. And it's out there and available to the world. And if you don't think that filters back to your child, you're wrong. What are your thoughts about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's not just in custody. I've used social media commentary in support cases where you've got a parent who's claiming they're disabled, they can't work, they're not working.
Right.
Yet on the internet, they're advertising their services for whatever they can do to earn money. I had a gentleman once years ago who was advertising that he was selling drugs online, and people were writing to him on Facebook, you know, I'll meet you at 6th and Catherine, whatever it was, at 8 o'clock to pick up the weed. And he says, okay. And it's all there on Facebook. All these transactions are taking place.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, of course, is that the obscene, ridiculous exception? Sure it is. But it's even the point of just making commentary about the other side or about the judge or about whatever. You know, if you write it, it's there forever.
And if you think you've erased it, you should know by now there are screenshots. And those screenshots live forever. So don't think that just because you've erased it, it's not an issue anymore.
Yep. No question about it.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts about talking about the family of the other parent? You know, have you had any cases where one parent will talk about the grandparents and that becomes an issue that is raised in a custody case?
Sure, because many times in this day and age, grandparents are integral parts of the family support unit. They're integral parts of the pickup and delivery or watching the children or raising the children. Mm-hmm. And getting involved in that kind of commentary is also inappropriate and negative. And again, you raised such a great point, Lisa. Kids have access to Facebook too. So it isn't just the other parent seeing this, or it isn't just using this commentary to illustrate how somebody really feels. It's you're exposing your children to your venom.
Exactly. And in many of these cases, the children love these extended family members as well. These extended family members are part of these children's memories. They're parts of holidays. They are a source of emotional support for the kids. So tearing those folks down publicly does have an actual and immediate detrimental effect to the children's well-being emotionally. It is also, going back to one of the factors, the availability of extended family relationships is a factor that the court will assess in determining custody. So if there are close family relationships, you know, the child spends a lot of time with cousins and grandparents and aunts and uncles, those people are important to the children, and the court wants to ensure that the child still has access to those folk.
I had a custody relocation case this year where the dad, my client, the dad worked very long hours, and he wanted primary custody of his daughter, who was like a little six-year-old little girl. So, but the way it worked in his family was his mother took the child to school every day and lived with him along with the child. Mm-hmm. Picked the child up from school every day. When she picked the child up from school, she then went to his brother's house and he was home at work from work then, spent a couple of hours with the brother who had children. So this child every day was with dad, grandmom, uncle, and cousins. That's a very strong bond. Whereas mother had some stepchildren in her house, father had the entire nuclear family the child spent every day with. Right. That's an important factor.
Exactly. And it's the village.
Yeah.
It's the village. And yeah, it is not a bad thing to have all hands on deck when all hands are you know, healthy and supportive hands for a child. So the court in my estimation always looks favorably on that type of network of support for a child.
Conversely, though, it also isn't a dead loser for a parent who has no family in the area if there are long-term bonds that have been created with caretakers and neighbors and people who have, like you said, it's a village, like people who have truly helped raise this child. If those relationships are established but they're not blood relatives, mm-hmm, that can be equally as valuable.
Absolutely. And families, if we've learned nothing from this modern age, there are different configurations of family.
Boy, weren't there ever.
It's not necessarily blood relationships that form the support nucleus. And those, as you said, Leanne, I think it's really important. And you see a lot of this in litigation in Philadelphia. Caretakers, you know, as some folks characterize them, my play aunt, mm-hmm, who is somebody who is not a blood relative but has functioned as the role of an older female, an auntie role.
And I think, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I get into the rut of mother and father. Mm-hmm. But we have mother and mother, and we have father and father. And it's not what it used to be. It's a whole host of combinations.
Mm-hmm. And those combinations are you know, recognized under the law as having rights.
Yes, they are. Well, it looks like we're going to take our last break right now.
The Schwartz Jordan Law Group's philosophy in family law is simple: to provide you with the legal advice and support you need in order to make sound, educated decisions that prepare you for your future. They can help you with all types of family law issues, including the complete divorce process. Much of their practice involves contested or uncontested divorce matters, such as alimony and division of property, including retirement assets, stock options, and business interests. Schwartz Jordan have a great deal of experience assisting clients in family law issues involving children, paternity actions, child custody, and child support. They also represent clients outside of the divorce process, drafting prenuptial agreements and postnuptial agreements, and assisting with the modification of domestic orders and child support enforcement. For more information or to discuss your divorce or family law case, call Schwartz Jordan Law today at 215-967-9070. That's 215-967-9070, or go to their website, schwartzjordan.com.
A few minutes left. How do we want to wrap this up today? What do you think?
So I just think we should probably just recap. I think we should talk. The children's preference was one of the things we started out with
today. Yep.
And there is no hard and fast rule as to what age the children's preferences hold sway. It depends on the child's maturity level, their age, and their reasoning. And the child's, in most instances, the child is not going to say, I'm going to live with mom or I'm going to live with dad, because they're trying, they love both parents, and they're trying to be as neutral as possible.
But there are those cases where it just comes out,
yeah,
where a child does have a strong preference and will say it. Whether that preference is going to be given credence or whether it's going to have a lot of weight, again, goes back to the factors. But I think the child needs to be reassured that this is not about a choice. This is just about meeting with the judge and just talking about yourself and how you feel.
That's
and
right.
That's about it.
And I think most judges will say, hey, this is on me. I don't want you to think that when you walk out of here, young person, that that the decision is going to be on you.
It's not your fault.
It's not your fault.
Yep.
You know, I'm the person in the black robe. You have to carry none of this on your shoulders.
That's right. And I'm going to listen to you, but I'm not going to necessarily be guided by what you say.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to hear what your feelings are. And, yeah, I think that's really, really important news to give to your kid. And it may, you know, allay some of their fears of talking to this person, because, you know, it's not uncommon to hear from clients, my child does not in any way want to be involved in this case. And I think thinking and thoughtful parents don't want their children to be involved, but it's unfortunately a necessary evil in a custody case. They're going to be interviewed by the judge in most cases if they're of the right age.
If they're of the right age, it is required by statute that the court interview the child and give some consideration to what the child has to say.
And I've had cases, not uncommon, where that requirement has forced couples to come to a resolution. To settle a case themselves. You know, what we've talked about for the last hour is litigation, but be aware that we spend a lot of our day settling and resolving cases without having to go to court. That's possible. That's encouraged. And that's the best possible result.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to say that you're absolutely right, that having the prospect of a child on the stand does resolve some cases. I had a really difficult case where there was a child who was 12 or 13. She had older siblings who were adults, and the adult children were going to testify. And that was a difficult decision for the mother who wanted to put the children on the stand, and the adult children who wanted to be on the stand. About a particular issue, which was getting the younger child therapy and getting the father therapy. And putting the adult daughter on the stand, the father just had to see the adult daughter on the stand for him to back down and say, okay, this is serious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to agree that these things need to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, it is not a decision to be taken lightly. And that was a Solomonic moment.
Well, I think that thinking parents who have their eye on the ball,
mm-hmm,
and have the best interest of their child or children at the forefront of their decision making, if you've got two parents who are both of that mindset, to work this out outside of court intervention doesn't mean you can't have a custody order, and you should have a custody order in my view in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
But to work this out and not have to go through the trauma of a trial and the expense of a trial, boy, that really is wonderful.
Absolutely. And we also talked about the attempts of a parent to turn the child against the other parent. It doesn't work. Judges see through. Judges are really good at seeing when children have been coached, first of all. So if parents think they're going to pump the child full of things to say that would be favorable to their cause, judges are going to see through that. A child is not going to be able to recite those reasons very convincingly in front of a judge. So I think that's all I have to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work. You shouldn't try to turn your child against the other parent.
It will backfire. Most of the judges in Philadelphia who do custody work, most of them have been doing custody work for a long time, and they can see through it. And it's going to backfire. It's going to be held against you before this case is over.
And if not just in the case, a child eventually is going to grow up and figure out what happened.
Yep.
And the reckoning may not come at the court hearing, but it's going to come, and it's going to compromise your relationship with your child. So just
sure
don't
is.
Do it.
Yep, absolutely.
The other thing we talked about is the factor which parent is more likely to maintain a loving, stable, and consistent nurturing relationship and how judges view that making a custody determination.
Mm-hmm. And I think it just goes back to being a good, responsible parent with your child, and the word is parent. You're not their friend. You're not in the role of providing a good time. Of course you're going to have a good time. You want to have a good time, but your role as a parent is to be a parent.
And I would like to that's absolutely right, Lee, and I would like to add to that that sometimes when you're acting in the role of a parent, with all things being equal, with all things being equal meaning that both parents are fit, part of your role as a parent is to say, hey, child, I know that you would rather stay here, but you have another parent, and it's important for you to spend time with that other parent who loves you, and I know you love that other parent, too. It's to make sure that you encourage the relationship between the parent and the other child.
Just remember, your kids love both parents in those cases. Their goal is to get you back together. Now, that's probably not going to happen. But they love both parents and encourage that love. It's in your children's best interest. Well, this was a lot of fun today.
This was fun.
Let's do it again.
Hey, maybe next month?
Next month. First Saturday of each month, me and you.
All right. Sounds good, Lee.
All right.
Just like in the office.
There you go. Have a good day, everybody.
You've been listening to Ask the Experts with Lisa Jordan and Lee Schwartz of Schwartz Jordan Law Group. Have a good month, everyone.
There you go.
Thanks for listening to the Ask the Expert show today. Join us again next week for more specialists in their field of legal health, financial, and home improvement.